Thank you very much. And is this working?
You can hear
me. Okay. Thanks very much for the invitation. In my 15 minutes, I've three main things to say, and then I'll conclude. The first part of what I have to say is addressing this question. Isn't just war thinking Christian and therefore irrelevant? To which I respond, first of all, no, it isn't just Christian. Certainly since 1977, when Michael Walzer published his seminal book, Just and Unjust Wars, there has been a healthy secular, moral, philosophical interest in just war thinking. So it's not just Christian and religious. What's more, you will find similar lines of thinking in Islamic tradition. And when I paid my first ever visit to Hong Kong 2 Augusts ago, for the first time I found myself confronted with Confucian and Neo-Confucian thinking about just war, and I was astounded at the similarities between that tradition and the Latin Western Christian tradition, even though those two cultures had not met until about 1700. So no, just war thinking is not just Christian. But you might say, or someone else might say, in a plural society such as ours, surely a secular philosophical version is preferable. That's to say, one that operates in a rational, secular language that everyone can understand. No, I don't think so. I don't think so because I don't believe in the possibility of secular language. That's to say, I don't believe that there is a set of terms that's neutral between rival worldviews, which members of a plural society like ours should adopt when communicating with each other about public affairs. Nor do I believe that religious worldviews are irrational as such, and that public discourse has to be non-religious in order to be rational. As I see things, there is no view from nowhere. There is no view from nowhere. There are only diverse confessions. And what's more, non-religious views, be they Aristotelian or Hobbesian or Kantian or Marxist or Nietzschean, are quite as plural and quite as conflicting as religious ones. How then can we communicate? How then can we perhaps reach agreement? Not by adopting some allegedly neutral, spurious position or language, but rather by setting out as candidly and clearly as we can what we think and why we think it, by inviting others to do the same, by engaging in the give and take of conversation, by identifying points of agreement, by reasoning together about points of disagreement, and by learning from one another. I don't doubt that non-Christians will be puzzled by some things that I, as a Christian, say, and I don't doubt that they will disagree with others. But I'm equally confident that many non-Christians will find things in what I say with which they can agree. After all, the common world that we all inhabit does rein in the divergence of our different constructs. And what's more, different traditions are seldom absolutely strange to one another. Certain strands of Christianity and Islam incorporate Aristotle, and both Locke and Kant are both more theological than atheist moral philosophers usually care to remember. So in brief, my view of secularity and of how to cope with a society in which there are a variety of different moral and political views present. My view is Augustinian. That's to say, secularity is the place where plural voices put their differences on the table, negotiate and compromise. So I'm not apologetic about representing a Christian view of just war thinking, whilst I recognise there are other views too. So the second question I want to address is whether a religious Christian view of just war thinking has anything distinctive to contribute. And my argument is yes, it does. There are various ways of construing the justification of war, some religious, some not religious, some Western, some not. In permitting different voices expression, and in not requiring all of them to speak the same secular language, we make it possible, first of all, to hear something different, and maybe then even to learn something true. Now, it might be assumed that Christian thought about just war is passé, and that it's been surpassed by modern philosophical versions. However, if you were to pick up one of the best books on just war thinking published in recent times, in my view, by the liberal philosopher David Rodin, you will find there, I think, a very cogent critique of Michael Waltz's or Waltzerian just war thinking. A critique that inadvertently, I've argued, vindicates a number of points in Christian tradition. One point is this. I think, and certainly Christian tradition takes this view, I think that just war is to be understood as basically punitive. It's basically a form of punishment. This is not a popular point of view. David Rodin, for example, takes national self-defense as the paradigm of a just war. And I think that's a mistake. To make national self-defense simply the model of justified war issues in some counterintuitive judgments. For example, that as soon as the Allies invaded the borders of Nazi Germany, Hitler's belligerency became self-defensive and so justified as defense. And the Allies' war-making became aggressive and as such, therefore, unjustified. That's crazy. But what it reveals is that to identify justified war with national self-defense is more or less simplistic, ignoring questions of motive, intention, cause, and proportion. Now, in contrast to Rodin's understanding of just war as the paradigm of just war being national self-defense, in contrast to that, the Christian tradition holds that justified war is always basically a response to grave injustice, and Lord Guthrie referred to this in relation to the criterion of just cause. A just cause for war has to be a grave injustice that requires rectifying. Okay? Now, the response to a grave injustice can take either defensive or aggressive forms, depending upon circumstance. It may move seamlessly from defense to aggression, or it may begin with aggression. Justified aggression is what so-called humanitarian intervention is all about. And the doctrine of the responsibility to protect is, in effect, a reassertion of the classic Christian paradigm of justified war. Now, this paradigm involves a claim about justified war that is very controversial and arouses quite some alarm, namely, the claim that war is, the basic form of justified war is punitive. Therefore, some people think that's a good reason why just war thinking needs to cut loose from Christian tradition, because the notion of just war as punitive is a dangerous notion. It is Christian, therefore let's cut loose from that. Why do they think that? They think that because to allow just warriors to think of themselves as punishing the enemy is to encourage just warriors to loosen the constraints on how they wage war. Now, in brief, my response to this is as follows. If justified defence is only and always defence against an injustice, it necessarily has the form of retribution. By retribution, I do not mean retributivism. I don't mean the ethic that prescribes an eye for an eye, a wasteland of equal suffering. What I do mean is it comes from the etymology of the Latin verb retribuere, meaning literally a handing or paying back. So by retribution I mean simply a hostile reaction to grave injustice. Now the question of what you intend to achieve through one's hostile punitive reaction remains open and is yet to be determined. It could be one of several ends. It could be defence, it could be deterrence, it could be reform or rehabilitation or reconciliation. And in Christian eyes, the end or goal of punishment should never be the suffering of the unjust perpetrator for its own sake. Justified war, therefore, is punitive in its basic form, but not retributivist. It is a hostile reaction to injustice, but it doesn't aim simply to make the perpetrator suffer for its own sake. Okay, in my view, this understanding of justified war is better than the view that says that justified war is mainly about self-defense. It is a view that is consistently held in Christian tradition and is not held in other traditions of just war thinking. Okay, so there's one point where I think, one respect in which I think the Christian tradition is better. Many disagree. Okay, my third and last section is about the way in which just war thinking continues to adapt and develop. Because one reason for supposing that just war thinking is irrelevant, and John Loughran alluded to this in his introduction, is that it was designed to regulate certain kinds of war. But since it was first designed, novel kinds of war have come into play. Therefore, this tradition of thinking is obsolete. I want to say that that is not the case. I want to say that just war thinking does adapt to various forms of war, and over the last 1500 years has adapted to different situations and different kinds of war. And to illustrate both these points, I'm going to finish simply by describing two ways in which my own thinking about just war has developed in the face of two recent cases. So here are two examples, in my case, of development. First of all, the rebellion in Syria in 2011. Let me refresh your memory about that. So in the first week of March 2011, 10 children in Deraa in Syria, aged between 9 and 15, wrote, well, they did what everyone did in school here in the 1960s. They on a school wall, they wrote, "Down with the system." If you're my age, you did that. I didn't, but my friends did. They wrote, "Down with the system," on the school wall. But unlike what didn't happen to me and my mates in Syria in 2011, the Syrian authorities arrested these young kids. They sent them to Damascus. They interrogated them and, according to some reports, tortured them. On the 15th of March, a few hundred protesters, many of them relatives of the detained children, began protesting in downtown Deraa. Their ranks swelled to several thousand. Syrian security forces, attempting to disperse the crowd, opened fire and killed four people. The next day, the crowd ballooned to about 20,000. On 23rd of March, the security forces killed at least a further 15 civilians and wounded hundreds of others. The crucial point is the next one. President Assad subsequently refused to punish the governor of Deraa or to reprimand him in any fashion, the governor of Deraa being his cousin. The Syrian rebellion, as I read it, was originally an act of non-violent protest against an arbitrary and ruthless state. Or at least an arbitrary and ruthless act. of the state. Only when it became clear that the state was unrepentant, that's to say, the very centre of the state, the president, was prepared to own the arbitrary act of the governor, only then did peaceful protest develop into armed rebellion. And for that reason, I think it justified. Okay, so how did my thinking about just war develop in relation to this case? The basic criterion of justified war is just cause, which must comprise grave injustice requiring rectification. What reflection on the Syrian rebellion taught me was that the injustice doesn't just need to be grave, it needs to be systemic. It would be one thing if the governor of Deraa was a maverick and did what he did, and that the president then removes him from office. The state repents. That's one thing. In this case, the president confirmed what had been done, which indicated the state was not open to reform. Therefore, the rebellion was an act of last resort, because no peaceful means were available. But what I learnt was, therefore, the cause has to be an injustice that is grave, but also systemic, not just occasional or accidental. That's my first lesson. So, just war theory does develop. Second example is this. This concerns Israel's Operation Protective Edge against Hamas in Gaza last year. Let me make clear that my reading of this case depends upon my knowledge of the political facts. The interpretation of the facts is controversial. I'm not an expert on Israel and Palestine. If you persuade me my reading of the facts is wrong, my moral judgment will change. But until then, here it is. It is clear, both in morality and in international law, that Israel had a right to defend her citizens against indiscriminate killing by Hamas's rockets, it seems to me. It's not so clear that her self-defense was proportionate, either in the sense of strictly necessary or in the sense of instrumentally apt to the end. So there are two senses of proportion at work here. Strictly necessary or apt to the end. Provided that Israel targeted enemy combatants and that such targeting was necessary, there was no upper limit to the number of civilian casualties that may have been incurred tragically as collateral damage. If you are beginning to react to that statement, as you probably should, let me try and defend it by taking you aside for a moment into a different case. When the Allies invaded Normandy in 1944. When the Allies invaded Normandy, Allied bombers killed 35,000 French civilians, which is undoubtedly terrible and tragic. But let me suppose that most people in this room, as most other occasions when I mentioned this, regard the war against Hitler as justified. And you probably regard the invasion of Normandy as justified. So you do so in spite of the fact that 35,000 French civilians were killed as collateral damage. Would you say that it wasn't worth killing 70,000 French civilians or 100,000? Where's the upper limit? I'm not sure. Okay. If we're judging simply by numbers, I don't think it's clear, I don't think we can identify an upper limit. Provided the military means chosen are necessary, there's no absolute maximum to the collateral damage that may be incurred. There may be other ways we can limit the, other principles we can appeal to limit the number of acceptable civilian casualties, but I won't go into those right now. Nevertheless, we should interrogate the claim of necessity by asking about its end. To what end were Israel's chosen military means necessary? If it was to fend off harm to Israeli civilians, then it seems that Israel's Iron Dome missile system was already achieving that with, according to our own officials, 90% efficiency. I believe only 3 Israeli civilians lost their lives. I believe that's right. Now, it's arguable, of course, that complete defence has to extend beyond deflecting the harmful effects to uprooting the cause, and that would justify military action against Hamas, not simply fending off their rockets. Still, if the end was to uproot the cause of attacks on Israel, then military means alone did not suffice. Military means alone weren't apt. While the bombardment of Gaza weakened Hamas's military power, it couldn't uproot it without a political solution. Without a political solution, Hamas will simply revive to fight again as it is. So as I see it, it was within Israel's power to take diplomatic confidence-building initiatives without waiting for reliable Palestinian interlocutors. Unilaterally, she could have moved, in some form, to end the illegal settlements on the West Bank. Since she didn't, her military assaults on Gaza were inept and therefore disproportionate. Now, as I say, if I got the facts wrong, if I construe them wrongly, as at least one informed friend tells me I have, then I might need to revise that. But my main point is not to make a point, on this occasion, not to make a point about Israel and Palestine, just to illustrate what I learnt. What I learnt was that there is a political dimension to proportion, because just war can only ever be war fought for the sake of a just political solution. And military means have to be apt to that end, not simply to a more immediate defensive end. Okay? That's it. Thank you.